This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In an election year dominated by war and terrorism, amid a bitterly divided campaign with a very divided electorate, you might think there's precious little to laugh about, which may be why Molly Ivan starts her new book of collected columns on a serious note, warning that tides of indifference and corporate money threaten to overwhelm the political process that she's made a career out of skewering. But as her new collection of two decades of columns exemplifies, no matter how dark things may look, Ivins can always find something ridiculous to laugh about, usually a politician. The former co-editor of the Texas Observer unleashes her satirical barbs in a syndicated column these days. She's also the co-author of two bestsellers about longtime acquaintance and target George W. Bush. Her latest is Who Let the Dogs In? Incredible Political Animals I Have Known. Later on the program, Politics Iraqi Style, we'll hear how rumors about Prime Minister Iyad Alawi bolster his hard-nosed image. But now Molly Ivins joins us from the studios of member station KUT in Austin, Texas. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Neil.
If you have comments about any of the political animals you've known or about Molly Ivan's work, give us a phone call. What about politics is funny these days? Do you ever laugh at your own side? And what makes you laugh at it? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Molly, I hope we get to the funny stuff, but I cannot overlook the sense of alarm that you begin this book with. Almost with our permission, you write, I think we're close to losing all of it. The Constitution, freedom, rule of law, even the dream of social and economic justice. Do you really think things are that bad?
Well, things are grim. Not that I ever thought politics was just wonderful and dandy and all on the up and up, but I'm sort of amazed to find as the years pass that it's getting worse. Better, I'm just getting grumpy. I really think that we are awfully close to corporate oligarchy, rule by corporate wealth. And it's the reason it's pretty simple and pretty obvious. I mean, we have a system of so-called campaign financing that's really legalized bribery. And until we fix that, we're in big trouble. The politics themselves, I think, are this presidential campaign, I think, is not a political campaign in any sense. It's a public relations campaign with an advertising campaign.
The comparison you made was you were as scared now as you were the night of the Saturday Night Massacre back in Watergate days when you said you were afraid Richard Nixon would call out the troops. Well, as it turned out, the Republic survived that and survived a lot of other things.
Right, and that's what it's always consoling to take the long view. And as I say, I think it's funny and I find a great deal to laugh at, but I think that there are lots of signs of advancing creepiness. And if you really want to know, I mean, just how far it's gone, when I say almost with our permission, I mean, it is literally now understood that the government of this country, until that Supreme Court decision came out recently, that the government claimed it had the right to take an American citizen, put him in jail indefinitely, hold him in prison indefinitely, without the right to see a lawyer, without the right to trial, without knowing what he could be charged with. And no one is... before the French Revolution, they did away with a legal instrument that made it possible for the king to do things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absent that Supreme Court decision, though, which was 8-1, after all.
Yes, it was, and firmly saying that American citizens do, in fact, still have legal rights, which is real nice, except you remember that the Patriot Act sailed through Congress with, as I recall, just one negative vote.
If the country is so polarized, which it obviously is, earlier I was asking listeners to call in and speak to the point as to whether they could laugh at their own side. Is that possible these days?
Well, I should hope so, although I do keep running across citizens who seem unable to talk about politics without getting all red in the face and the tendons stand out on their necks and their wattles shake like a turkey gobbler, and I'm, good heavens, it's alarming. I'm afraid they're going to stroke out right in front of me.
The thing that you say we have lost track of in politics is the divide between the rich and the poor. What happens to ordinary folks?
I really think that the sort of two-track economy, the two Americas theme that John Edwards talks about, is very real. And it's curious to me that more of us aren't aware of what's happening to our lives. In other words, the impact that political decisions have on our lives, it's really startling when you hear people say things like, well, I'm just not interested in politics. Oh, well, they're all crooks. Well, there's nothing I can do. And those are the three that really set me off. Because while I think it's funny, I also think that you can no more opt out of politics as though it were a picture on the wall or a program on television that you decide you just don't care for than you can take up and fly. It's your life.
Yet you point out that in this country, and even with this government that you're so critical of, people have the right to get out and rabble-rouse, organize themselves, organize others.
Exactly. That's the whole point when you say there's nothing I can do. Well, obviously no one is going to pretend that you, Joe Citizen, have as much clout as some guy who gives $1 million a year to one or the other of the parties or to political candidates. Obviously you don't. On the other hand, you do have some leverage, not just your vote, but you can round up other people who agree with you and go out and register other people and raise hell and have fun doing it.
And at the same time, you talk about a political campaign that you say is pretty much a PR. We've seen a revolution in some respects. The effect of the Internet, the small contributors, I think Howard Dean has to take a lot of the credit for this.
Oh, I'm really excited about the possibilities that the Internet offers, not just in politics, where, of course, it is now a major player. The first thing people who are professionals at politics, consultants and journalists like myself, always ask about a candidate is he serious? Is she a serious candidate? And what that means is, do they have real money? Well, suddenly here is real money being raised, $30, $40 million, on the Internet from real people in small amounts. This is so exciting. I mean, it has so much potential. And I think the Internet is important in another way. I think this may actually break through the corporate media and the problems we're having in journalism as a result of the concentration of ownership of media.
Mm-hmm. Though you warn about the dangers of the times in which we live, you also come out at the end sounding optimistic anyway.
Well, I am optimistic, always, to the point of idiocy. And so naturally, my whole life, this is a congenital defect, I had expected that I would become an unnaturally cheerful old fart. And what has happened now that I'm turning 60 is that I find myself grumpy about some major things in this world. And two of them are politics and journalism.
Well, we'll let listeners call in and ask about both. Our number, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest, of course, is Molly Ivins, author most recently of Who Let the Dogs In? Incredible Political Animals I Have Known. And let's get a call in from Karen, who's with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hey, Molly. How you doing, girl?
Doing all right.
Good. We miss you here. Wish you would come back. I have two stories for you, both about our state ledge, which is working hard to be as funny as and as awful as Texas. But one is, actually it's about the governor. We call him Governor Goofy, Mark Sanford. In his State of the State address, the first one that he did after being elected, he announced to a completely bemused and befuddled audience on television, radio, and in person that his political mentor, hero, was the world-famous Mustafa Kemal, also known as Ataturk of Turkey. And the reason for this was that he felt that Ataturk had brought his country into the modern world, neglecting to mention that he, Ataturk, banned all public display of political exercise of religious beliefs in public. And the other one is that our governor also is leading our state in its opposition to itself. We have about 9 school districts in South Carolina that are suing the State Department of Education, the governor, and everybody because they don't get enough money in comparison to the other school districts. So please look around and write about South Carolina. There's a lot here for you to do some good work in.
Oh, I'm telling you, the material just rains down in the tropics as a gentle rain from heaven.
You can't make
it. It's really wonderful. I must say, I always thought Ataturk was some Turk. I mean, he despite the fact that he dragged his country to some extent into the modern era somewhat forcefully, he really was a pretty admirable guy.
Karen, thanks very much for the phone call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Patrick. Patrick's with us from South Bend, Indiana.
Hi. Just a quick question from Ali. I have a book here that's entitled "I Hate George W. Bush." It's a reader. It's a collection of articles, and there's one of your articles included in this book. I just basically wanted to know, and perhaps this was addressed while I was waiting on the phone, what your personal feelings toward him as a person are. Could you equivocally say that you hate George W.
Bush? I'm not a George W. Bush hater. And interestingly enough, that was the headline put on an article I wrote for the Progressive magazine. If you read the piece itself, I think you'll find that, in fact, I rather clearly say I'm not a Bush hater. I think his policies are dreadful. But no, I don't hate George W. I've known him for a long time. He's not stupid. He's limited, real limited.
You've known him since high school.
Yeah, and not well, I should emphasize, but he hung out with friends of mine and dated girls I knew. He was, you know, sort of moved in the same crowd, I
you
guess.
You went to different
speaking.
Prep schools in Houston.
Yeah, well, he went to school back in the East, and then he went to the rival prep school in Houston before that.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you then followed his career, but actually his political career, other than, obviously, 6 years as governor of Texas?
Right. Short is the best way to describe it until he started running for president. He really had no political experience except for being governor of Texas, which, of course, was pretty funny in itself because being governor of Texas, I have to tell you, is not that big a deal. Our state, like a lot of southern states, has the weak governor system and put in to, of course, serve the Yankees right after Reconstruction. And as a result, being governor of Texas is about the fifth most powerful, important job in the state. The lieutenant governor has much more power than the gov.
I wonder about Patrick's point, though. Do you find that these days Democrats hate George Bush the way a lot of Republicans hated Bill Clinton?
You know, that was proposed to me very seriously by a right-wing talk show host, Bill O'Reilly, in fact. And I have heard liberals who are normally, of course, bleeding hearts. The milk of human kindness runs deep through every vein of our, you know, and we weep copiously for everybody from the milk-shy Hottentots to the glandular obese and can hardly be brought to even have an argument. I mean, truly, you insult a liberal and the first thing they are likely to say is, well, you may have a point. So I've been sort of interested and amused to see that we do have some grudge holders on our side. And I think it goes back to the feeling a lot of people have that Bush did not win the election in 2000. And I'm kind of amazed that they hold a grudge for an entire 4 years. But they seem to feel that they're entitled to it and to some extent even relish it. But I think there's a kind of, I don't know how to explain it because I'm, you know, I have no pretensions to psychological expertise, but there's some kind of screw that gets loose with people and they take out a lot of their personal anger in politics. Mm. Displaced anger is what the shrinks call it. And they're usually mad at the wrong person entirely. With the people who are mad at Bush, I think there is the combination of the policies and then the feeling that he doesn't tell the truth.
Patrick, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more of your calls, 800-989-8255, and emails, totn@npr.org. Our guest is Molly Ivins. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with columnist Molly Ivins about her new book, Who Let the Dogs In?, a collection of her columns that have been printed over the past 20 years. Of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line. Jan's with us from Marshfield, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hi, Jan.
Hi. Hi, Molly.
Hi there.
My question is, and I read Bushwhacked, mm-hmm. and I think you took the position that George Bush is kind of a manufactured cowboy. And since you stated earlier that you knew him prior to, or, you know, pre-political uh-huh. George, what was pre-political George like? Was he...
He was an oil man from Midland.
Did he do all that, you know, the smirk and all this stuff, or was this something that just kind of came about later?
Well, he was an oil man from Midland, and then, of course, he owned the baseball team in Dallas. He was a businessman, certainly more than a cowboy. The ranch he actually bought when he decided to run for president in 1998, and they didn't get the house built until after he got elected president. It's not like an old family ranch or anything. A lot of Texans pretend to be weekend ranchers. That's not unusual. Wealthy Texans do that a lot. What was he like? He was affable, amiable, not very impressive. I used to say he's like everybody you ever had dinner with at the Midland Petroleum Club. Came away thinking, gosh, what a swell bunch of fellas. Thank God they're not running the world. You know, what I always try to say about Bush is that I think his policies are terrible. I think he has so little interest in policy and so little faith in government at all as an instrument for helping people that it doesn't really occur to him that they're doing damage.
Thanks, Jan.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's go now to Tina. Tina's in Wall, South Dakota.
Hi,
Wall.
Molly.
We're home of Wall Drug?
Yes, actually, I'm at Wall Drug right now.
Unbelievable. A very famous drugstore, for those of you who don't know.
How can anybody not know? The signs are begin in Montauk.
Yes, true. Okay, my question for Molly is, I was introduced to her in my journalism class at Averitt College, and I've been a fan of her ever since. Do you, Molly, blame Ann Richards for the state of our nation today? In other words, if she had taken Bush more seriously when he ran for governor, which she didn't, would our nation be in this terrible condition as it is today?
Ann Richards, of course, the former Democratic governor of Texas who lost an election to George W. Bush. Go ahead.
Right, and... yes and no. I don't think Ann really wanted to win re-election. I think she was exhausted after that first term, which was pretty hard on her. So I don't think she ran a very good campaign against W. On the other hand, I'm one of those people who gives W a lot of credit as a politician. I don't think he's just, you know, Karl Rove's puppet or anything like that. I think he's very good at the political end of politics. Okay. And policy bores him, but the getting elected part he knows and he's good at. And I think he and Rove are more like partners than he is a puppet.
Right.
And, you watch him. He's not going to get off message again between now and the election. He's got a new thing. He's going around now running as the peace president and a man of peace and how much he wants peace. It's really interesting to see him do things like that.
Tina, what are you shopping for?
Actually, I'm traveling through, and I just saw the millions of signs, and I thought, well, I have to check this place out.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. Have a good trip.
Okay, thank you, Molly.
Here's an email that we have from Celine Grenier. If you would agree that many in the red states are voting against their own economic interests by voting Republican and vote that way because they believe they are voting their traditional values, do you have anything to say about how ethical, life, family value rich the Republican Party is?
Well, I'm not sure that people really are snookered. Yes, I think to some extent people vote against their own economic self-interest because they perceive gay marriage or pornography or something as some horrible threat to, or see the country just becoming sleazy and tawdry in a way they don't like. I think that's sort of a reasonable point of view, not so much getting snookered. But to the extent that they vote against their own economic self-interest, I think they're wasting their vote and voting against themselves. then you say, well, you know, how can we keep fooling people like that? Oh, it's pretty easy, I think. And sometimes I think in some ways liberals make it easy.
How?
I'm a populist myself. I think it's much more important to talk about real stuff, really things that impact people's lives, and not get off so much into identity politics and all the rest of it.
Well, how do liberals make it easy?
Well, first of all, we're always standing up for unpopular causes. And what I always think when we do that is that we need to do it more emphatically. For example, people who are interested in freedom of speech are always defending the right of some miserable, awful person to spew some vicious drivel. And you just have to say to people, yep, by gum, and it's important to do so. The other, you know, things like prayer in school and flag waving and all that. See, I don't think that really does matter to people, but you have to explain, if you're going to be opposed to a constitutional amendment to forbid burning the flag, you got to tell people why, and why it's American, and why it's important.
Let's get another caller in. Renee's with us from Mill Valley, California.
Hello?
Hi, Renee. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd like to know, Ms. Ivins, what you think, if you're familiar with the recent article in the Atlantic Monthly by James Fallows, about W's effectiveness as a debater when he went up against Ann Richards in the gubernatorial contest in Texas. Fallows writes about reviewing the tapes of these and other presentations while he was running for and in office in Texas as being really quite an effective communicator, but now his presentation of self and talking style seems, to many of us anyway, to be that of a dolt. Fallows can't really explain this. What's your thought?
You know, I think that may be more in Fallows' perception than reality. It's my recollection that Bush's great contribution during his political debate when he was running against Ann Richards was not to mess up and do anything horrible. I don't recall him as brilliantly effective or particularly articulate. I mean, he just seemed like he's pretty much his normal self. Now, people who hear him tangle up words sometimes assume that he does that a lot. He doesn't. Unlike his daddy, who truly had trouble expressing himself in English, you can almost always tell what it meant to say, even if he doesn't get it quite right.
Well, his responses always seem to be so shallow, and as you point out, always on message, that nothing of substance ever seems, at least to me, to be said. So
yes,
I found it hard to believe that he could have been effective in Texas when he wasn't. When he hasn't been in my experience as a national candidate and president. So, thanks.
Well, I don't remember any brilliantly articulate George W. at any point. He would wander off message in his first race from time to time, and about halfway through the summer, Rove just called him over to East Texas for a come-to-Jesus session, and he never got off message again for the entire campaign. You could ask him about the weather, and he'd talk about the sharp increase in juvenile crime under Ann Richards.
Renee, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I have to say that from what you've written about John Kerry, he's not exactly a thrill for you either.
Well, no, I might always feel that I should be allowed to point out the obvious. You know, John Kerry, he's a boring stiff. And, you know, that's not to say that he's not a boring stiff with intelligence and gravitas and courage and hopefully better sense than to drag us into an unnecessary war, but a boring stiff nonetheless.
Are you off to Boston next week to watch
you
the
bet. You bet. Minus zero on the Elvis scale, Mr. Senator Kerry may be, but He's like the only other game in town, so I'll be there.
Well, there's an email question that we have from Michelle in Salt Lake City. What do you think about Ralph Nader, the other player in the game?
I don't, like everybody else this year, I wish I could think of something original to say about this, but I'm just, you know, blackbird journalism. I just wear everybody. I do not understand why he's running. It seems to me there is no chance this year that he is going to get his issues on the table by running this race. And it is so clear that he's being funded by Republicans who just want to hurt John Kerry. I can't believe Ralph Nader, who, you know, spent a career trying to help average citizens against big corporations, really thinks he's doing any good here. He apparently has persuaded himself, though. And you got to figure it's an ego trip. I mean, it's we've seen people get bit by the political bug before and not be able to quit running ever. Harold Stassen was kind of a famous national joke in that category.
Let's get another caller in. Dave is with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, my question is for Molly Ivins.
Go ahead.
Molly, I used to be a publisher of a small newspaper here in Portland, and one of the things that has concerned me over the years is the apparent deterioration of the popular news media. And I was wondering if you could comment on the top two or three things that you see are as concerning you and maybe some things that we could do about that.
I really think I know people have been sitting around direly warning about the terrible influence of the concentration of ownership of media, which is one of those phrases that sort of is real hard to get excited about. But I think what we're finally seeing is the effects of that concentration on the quality of journalism in this country. I'll tell you how it works at, you know, the level I'm at. Your paper, the last paper I worked for, was sold three times during the 10 years I worked for it to increasingly larger media giants every time. And there is no censorship in the sense that somebody from Giant Galactic Media International, you know, calls from their headquarters in New York City and says, Molly Ivins can't criticize George Bush in a Texas newspaper. Nobody ever does things like that. What happens is that some bean canner in New York who knows nothing about journalism and cares less puts his telescope down on the property in Texas, the little newspaper down here, and says, oh, our little newspaper down in Texas is not making the same rate of return as our little newspaper in Kansas City, which is the same size. We'll have to call them and tell them to get their quarterly profits up. And then what happens is you have a profit squeeze, which, as an old cynical editor of mine once remarked, means that the profits are down from obscene to excessive. And the only way to squeeze more money out of a newspaper is to either cut the news hole so there's not as much space for news, or to cut the staff so there aren't as many people to go out and gather it. And ultimately what you get is less information in your newspaper. And
Do you see some of the pressures that newsprint people face, declining circulation, declining advertising as being a factor?
Yes, I do, but I also think that a good deal of newspaper problems are the way we present ourselves. I've argued from the beginning of my career that you don't have to be dull and boring to do good news and to do news well. When I started in this business, the typical political story began, House Bill 327 was passed out of subcommittee by a unanimous vote on Tuesday. No one ever got to the second paragraph of that story. Half the time I think stories at least at our legislature should begin, look out, you're getting screwed again. that's kind of much closer to the truth. And so I think some of it is the fault of the dull traditions of establishment journalism, and some of it is that print is no longer the dominant medium of communication. Now, I think that the internet is a really interesting break. It's not, especially since what you're really looking at is a completely different, oh, I hate this word. I'm going to have to use it, though. Paradigm. Paradigms and a nickel will get you a Coke.
Not anymore.
Not right. I guess that's true. If you've got, like, the New York Times, it goes down to one reader and then another reader and then another reader. CBS News goes out to one viewer, then another viewer, then another viewer. What the internet does is put every reader in touch with every other reader and every viewer in touch with every other viewer.
Dave, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with Molly Ivins. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Your bio in this book says you began on the complaint desk at the Houston Chronicle?
I was the entire complaint department of the Houston Chronicle.
What kind of calls did you used to get?
Oh, absolute beauties. One of the first things I learned by being the complaint department is that people hold the news media responsible for what's happening in the world, not just how we report it, but actually what's happening. And you talk about understanding that you're never going to be in a really popular business. And then people also call the complaint department. Well, the worst day of my entire career is the complaint department was the day the Chronicle failed to run the horoscope.
Oh,
it's called the AstroCast. And there were people who had not been able to go out of their houses all day. They did not know whether it was their day to go out and do business. I mean, it upset a lot of people.
You've done a lot of different things. You were a political reporter for the New York Times for a while. You were co-editor of the Texas Observer. What's the best job you've ever had?
Well, I'm either incredibly lucky or I'm really easy to please, because I've had what I thought was the best job in American journalism three times. Be an editor of the Texas Observer, a small progressive magazine down here in Texas, which of course paid no money at all, was so much fun. I did it for 6 years, and I had such a good time, I should have been arrested. And it was, of course, also my opportunity, because it was a small paper, and they let you make your own mistakes, which is the only real way to learn. It was where I learned how to be a political writer. And the freedom and the opportunity they gave me was just extraordinary. The fact that they didn't pay me at all hardly made any difference. Mm-hmm. The second great job I had was Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief for the New York Times. It's certainly my experience that the best way to work for the Times is to be about 1,000 miles away from it.
Best way to work with almost any editor is to be about...
Exactly. And I loved the territory out there. I loved the western states, the mountains. It was just, it was a great job. And then I think that being a liberal political columnist in Texas is a great gig. I love it.
When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue our conversation with Molly Ivins. And we'll also discuss some rumors floating around about the Iraqi Prime Minister, Iyad Alawi. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow on the program, does the 9/11 Commission report make us reconsider the Bush administration's policy of preemption? Today, our guest is Molly Ivins. We're talking about her career, the lighter side, if there is one, about this year's election, and about her new book, Who Let the Dogs In? Incredible Political Animals I Have Known. 800-989-8255, totn@npr.org. And let's talk now with Robert. And Robert's on the line with us from Chicago.
Good afternoon, Molly. My question is, if John Kerry is so intelligent, why is he such a waffler? He's for the war. He's against the war. He's for No Child Left Behind. He's against No Child Left Behind. He's pro-choice, but he doesn't personally agree with abortion. Why does he waffle so much?
Well, I guess, you know, what I always say about Kerry, when you ask a question about Kerry, you have to look at the other guy. I always say Kerry's a boring stiff. This doesn't make George W. Bush Demosthenes. And likewise, if you look at George W.'s record, he waffles all the time. He was against the 9/11 Commission, then he was for the 9/11 Commission. He was going to let Condoleezza Rice not testify, and then he decided she could testify. First he's a war president, now he's a peace president. I mean, this guy has, at one time or another, endorsed every known foreign policy to mankind, and, you know, people just... It's one of those things that they do. They tagged Kerry early as a waffler, and they got it to stick, and so they're sticking to it. It seems to work.
Well, isn't it true?
But all of them changed their minds. Kerry is cautious. I interrupted.
Yep. Go ahead, Robert. I'm sorry.
I apologize. Wouldn't you agree, though, that most liberals plague every Republican president from Dwight D. Eisenhower to Ronald Reagan to Dan Quayle, who was vice president, of course? It seems as though liberals have a tendency to always plague them as to be dumb or stupid, but there's really no substantive argument behind, apart from calling them dumb or stupid. And I know you don't, because you believe that Mr. Bush is not stupid, but a little not altogether there, or whatever you termed it. But it just seems
limited.
Liberals have a tendency to limited. It just seems that liberals have a tendency to label every single Republican president stupid, and that's their line of attack.
Well, Well, I was trying to think. Of course, there are smart Republicans. I think I always thought Dole was one, and I was ashamed that he never emphasized his sense of humor. He has a very nice, dark sense of humor.
And nobody ever called Richard Nixon stupid.
No, weird, but not stupid. So I'm not sure that's true, although I can see how you would be tempted to conclude that. And again, with Bush, when I say limited, look, he's not a man who's widely read. Provincialism is a universal characteristic. But this guy really is a Texan, and Texans tend to be more provincial than others. And if you spend your life, most of your life in Midland, which really is out in the middle of nowhere, you tend to be even more provincial than that. He's not widely read. He's not interested in policy or governance. And Lord knows he was not. No one ever claimed that foreign policy was George Bush's forte. I mean, we thought when most of us people thought when they voted for him in 2000, well, he may not know much about the rest of the world, but he's going to have a good team around him. He's going to have people around him who know more than he does. And so it's all going to be okay. And the last thing anybody would have wished on this guy, whether you liked him or not, was a major foreign policy crisis in the middle of his first year.
Well, I'm just not sure that I understand your... you seem to disagree with almost all of his policies, yet Americans are, there's home ownership is up. There hasn't been another attack since 9/11 on American soil. And contrary to, popular liberal belief and what is portrayed in the media, which is almost virtually liberally owned and operated from the New York Times.
I don't accept that premise, but I understand that it's a common one.
Let me add this email that comes from a slightly different point from Beth Hartford DeRoos in Jackson, California. I live in a conservative area of California, and to be honest, the only reason I like GWB is because, unlike Kerry Incorporated, GWB doesn't make me feel inferior because I fly a flag on my home, attend church, hunt and fish, and simply love being an American who is live and let live, or live and let live, and leave me alone.
Well, now see, this is the kind of cultural stereotyping that I think is really interesting. I'm a Texan. I drive a pickup truck. I drink beer. I cuss. I hunt. I can go on and on like that, proving what regular folks I am. So what? I'm a liberal. I mean, for a lot of reasons, mostly because I really do think that government has responsibilities, and this guy's really messed it up. In fact, the guy who was trying to say what's wrong with George W. Bush, I don't see really how anybody could honestly argue that the country is better off than it was 4 years ago. The fiscal irresponsibility of this administration is just astonishing. They've put this country in a hock for years and years to come.
Let's talk now with Billy, and Billy's on the line from Vacaville, California.
That's correct. I'd just like to say that I love your show, and Ms. Ivins, I love your books. I was born and raised in Texas, and it's nice to hear a voice from home. And my question for you is, what advice do you have as the liberal stateswoman that you are for a young liberal who just became involved in the political process to make things better?
Oh, well, raise hell and have fun. I mean, that's the important part. You got to do both of those. I really do think politics should be fun, and I think we need to laugh more in this country about it.
Are there any conservative humorists who get you to laugh?
Oh, sure. My old friend PJ is funny.
PJ O'Rourke.
I'm trying to think. Well, as I say, Bob Dole, I always thought had a really good sense of humor. Sure. And, one nice thing about covering politics at this long and at various levels is that you get to know people as people. You don't politicians as people, so that a lot of times, you get fond of old right-wingers and people are just comical and interesting despite their politics.
Billy, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
As we get older, inevitably we start losing people. You've included memorials to some people in at the end of your book. Who do you miss?
Barbara Jordan is one of the people I saluted. Bless her heart. Paul Wellstone I thought was a real loss for our side. And there are several others. I always tell people that there are real heroes in politics, but it's best to wait until they're safely dead before you announce it, because they can always go wrong on you.
You're going to continue writing your column, having fun, and raising hell?
You bet.
Molly Ivins, thank you.
Material like this, it's hard to miss.
Thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
I enjoyed it.
Molly Ivins is a nationally syndicated columnist. Her new book is Who Let the Dogs In? Incredible Political Animals I Have Known. She joined us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas.